Continuing through these layers of dependent arising, after concentration in the liberative list comes this very important phase, the beginning of insight. And it's called knowledge and vision of seeing things as they are. So seeing things as they are. In the ordinary dependent arising, the corresponding step is the six sense faculties. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and the mind. It's through the six sense faculties that we experience things as they are. And that's very different than how most people would go about to understand, to see things as they are. Some people would get a book and read about it. Some people would think it out or analyze their situation, make lists, all kinds of things. But the means is the basic human capacity for sense context, sense experience, that apparatus. It's with that we experience things as they are. So in seeing that connection, we understand there's a radical shift in maybe even paradigm in how most people are usually operating. So to begin talking about this, I'm inspired to say that being alive is kind of special. It's an amazing thing to be alive. And sometimes we don't notice the experience of living in the present. That's the only place we can experience living. We don't experience it because we're so busy thinking about other things. But to take the time and just the idea of being the very nature of being conscious. Wow, how did that happen? Sometimes I think that the glimmers I have of being conscious is like gazing at the eighth wonder of the world. Wow, it's an amazing thing to be conscious. I like to think of it for myself. I'm inspired by maybe now it's cliche, but the idea that consciousness is nature's way of seeing itself. Out of this evolutionary soup that we evolved from, somehow things evolved, came together in such a way that there were conscious beings with eyes and ears and senses that could know. Nature knows itself. And there's a story of a monastery where miracles are supposed to happen. A skeptical philosophy professor decided to check this out, stormed into the monastery and said to the abbess, show me a miracle. If you have miracles here, show it to me. And the abbess looked him right in the eye and said, your next breath is a miracle. In Japan, they have an art of, or a way, and art is too limited for the sense. The way is almost like, it's like a deep practice of somehow living in harmony with this world or entering the world in a deep way that's done with flowers. And they have beautiful flower arrangements that happen. And they also have some places a little alcove in homes or in temples. I think it's called a tokomono. That it's, you know, a little bit like an altar, and it's kind of in its sense a special place, honored place in the home. And sometimes what's found there is a single flower. And this that particular flower somehow stands out in highlight in the suchness of the flower in a way that you would not see a flower if the flower was in a bouquet. And you go into these alcoves kind of give a feeling of silence, of stillness, of space, so that the uniqueness of that flower stands out by itself. There's a Zen story that the Buddha once upon a time held up a flower, a single flower. The assembly had gathered for the Buddha to give a Dharma talk. And all he did was lift a single flower up. And one person, one monk in the audience, Mahakashapa, smiled. And the Buddha recognized that Mahakashapa understood and passed the lineage to Mahakashapa. He became the next teacher after the Buddha died. That's a Zen story, at least. That's the Zen lineage comes through Mahakashapa. But what was it that Mahakashapa saw in seeing the flower that was so profound? Single flower, what was it? I suspect it wasn't just simply that he recognized it as a daisy. What was it? What's to be found in the particularity of something? It's not the uniqueness of something. What's to be found in the uniqueness of you? If the Buddha held you up, what would Mahakasapa see? It would cause him to smile, cause you to smile. Imagine someone who really wants to discover who they are, their unique self. They heard like, oh, this is like one of the great tasks of life is to know yourself. And they runs into a Zen master. And the Zen master says, oh, to know yourself, you have to first know emptiness. What in the world is emptiness? Well, I guess I have to go get the books, start studying up, reading about the philosophy of emptiness. There's even a big book that's titled The Emptiness of Emptiness. Scholarly book. Apparently there's a lot to write about emptiness. And but the person that asks the Zen master, where do I learn about emptiness? Oh, you have to go to Japan, to a Zen monastery there. So the person does, goes to Kyoto. And it's possible to go to the tourist agencies in Kyoto and say, I want to learn about Buddhism or Zen. And they'll say, okay, here. They did it. That's what they did for me one day. Go here, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I did, 6 o'clock in the morning. It was nice to walk through Kyoto that early because almost no one was out. It was very peaceful, quiet, cool. It was the fall. And turns out that it was a sub-temple of a large temple complex. And going down the streets and the lanes between these majestic Japanese Zen temples and gardens, and the stillness, the quiet, kind of once you get off the city streets, feel the quiet and the stillness of these monasteries early in the morning. And I found a small sub-temple temple I was supposed to go to. And it was going to have an impressive gate. Now, this is an authoritative place for Zen, just by the gate. And this beautiful, you know, gardens you walk into, and stepping stones, and well-tended, ancient, beautiful building. And I could feel my whole body shift and change, got quieter and stiller. Like going to a library, but with a more reverential feeling. So this person does that and has that and comes to the monastery and says, you know, I'm here. I was told that I have to understand emptiness before I can understand who I am or what the self is. And so can you teach me? And they said, oh, yes, of course. Come with me. And they start going into the monastery. And the deeper you go in the monastery, the temple, it's the more quiet and still it gets simpler. And finally you go through a little hallway and it opens up into a place that's very, very quiet and still cool. Even if there's sounds from outside, there's somehow the sounds are, I don't know, what stands out is the silence, the stillness, the simplicity of this meditation hall, the Zendo. Person wonders why they're going to sit there to get the lesson about emptiness. Couldn't they just sit in the easy chairs? And the Zen master says, here, sit here quietly on this round cushion by yourself. And search for emptiness. And, you know, don't come back to see me until you've found it. So here the person is, all alone, the uniqueness of the person. None of the usual reference points for understanding who they are and proving who they are and defending who they are, asserting who they are. None of the usual reference points of their daily life by which to define themselves. Just alone, and it's very quiet, peaceful. Where is emptiness? And the person realizes after a while that how many concepts and ideas the person had constructed, and well, that's not emptiness, and they drop away and feel all the feelings, lifetime of feelings that haven't been felt, and they come flooding in. And after a while, but they're not emptiness, they're quite full. Where's the emptiness? And over time, everything gets quieter and quieter and quieter, stiller and stiller. They're going through dependent arising without knowing it. And at some point, What's left is just their sense doors and how the sense doors and the contact with reality have sensations. And the person realizes that so many of the constructs and ideas of who they were, who they thought they were just that, constructs, ideas that were built on top of this. And none of those ideas, constructs, definitions, identities, really could be emptiness. So if I'm supposed to understand who I am, by understanding emptiness first, where's the emptiness? And then like the single flower that's highlighted stands by itself, because things have gotten so simple, each sensation, the singularity of each sensation stands out. A sound, a sight object, a smell, a taste, tactile body sensations. They're there, just the uniqueness of each one. Person realizes how much ideas, concepts, desires, pull these different sense experiences into stories, into larger concepts and ideas. The Buddha said that desire sows sensations into more complicated things. Through our desire, we take and we connect things and build things and ideas. But just the sense experience. And in that peaceful, quiet, still place, each of them is unique. And sometimes people feel it's so precious to just in a very quiet place to hear a sound. One of the most famous poems in Japanese poetry is, imagine a very quiet, sitting very quietly, peacefully, at the edge of the woods, maybe in the morning. No sound, everything is still sleeping and quiet, still, crisp and very still. And you're at the edge of a pond, lake. Your mind is as quiet and serene as a lake, as still as the air that's quiet. And suddenly, a frog jumps in, plop. That is one of the most famous poems in Japan, at least in Zen Japan, haiku. Frog jumps in, plop. So just, you know, each sound is like so pristine. To hear a monastery bell in this early morning in a Zen monastery, just the individual sounds, like primordial, awe-inspiring, bong, wow. But then the person sitting there sees that all these sensations, they come and go. It seems to be the nature of arising and passing, appearing and disappearing, surging and receding. At first, they seem to be solid, to last a long time. But that turned out to be one of the ways that Sensations get sewed together by our concepts. It's the concept of a knee, the concept of a knee that's hurting, that is constant, kind of. We kind of stay preoccupied, caught in the idea of a painful knee. But if the idea falls away, and we're really intimate with the knee, we'll see that it's not a solid pain. It's a dance of little points of sensations that appear and disappear, move around. Maybe there's a little square centimeter in which the dance occurs, but where the pain was a moment ago, it's not in the next moment. It's moved, you know, 1/10 of a millimeter to the right. Wow, just like, where is it? What is it? It's just like always, it's dance, movement. It was solid before. The knee now seems to have no solidity. In fact, it seems like it's empty. All there is now are these dancing sensations, but they're so fleeting that they're empty of any solidity, any lastingness. And in a certain kind of way, they seem like they themselves are empty of my concepts on them. Maybe I throw my concepts, ideas, and preferences on them. But it's kind of like trying to put your hand into a hologram and grab it to take it home with you. And you just, you know, just go through empty air, kind of. It's empty. Is this what the Zen master was talking about, the emptiness? What's the value of this? Is the uniqueness of this, not of the sensation, but of the arising and passing of the sensation, is that the Buddha holding up a flower? What is it? And then start seeing that these things that arise and pass, some of them quickly, some of them slower, they're so empty that actually it doesn't make sense to attribute self to them, to appropriate them as me, myself, and mine. They're just too fleeting, too empty for that. In fact, by the time I make a self out of it or have a thought, this is who I am, it seems like it's already gone. In any case, a lot of the ideas I have about who I am, now they get highlighted in the silence. They get highlighted almost like the flower being held up. Wow, it's just a thought. And these thoughts, they have no weight. They have no solidity. They seem to be empty too. And what does it mean that the ideas that I had about my precious self, the ideas are empty? And all the evidence that I can concretely touch and feel through my senses are empty. The reality is empty, and the ideas of reality are empty. It doesn't make any sense to see as the self. So how could the Zen master say that I was going to understand what the self is after I understand emptiness? There's no self here. In fact, it's disorienting. I kind of live my life based on the idea of the self. And there's a lot of people who have reinforced the idea that the self is really important. It so important that I've learned to judge it and believe I have an inadequate self or a really special self or a this and that self. But this strange experience of emptiness, I don't find anything. What is it? What's going on here? So the person continues sitting there and say, okay, well, I guess I'm going to just keep staying here and in this sacred temple and allow myself to really experience this because there must be more here. Person relaxes, settles in, and is not trying to understand anymore or fight the experience or do anything with the experience. It's just, okay, I guess this is it. I just kind of hang out with this or rest in this experience. And it turns out that they're doing so. More and more, everything seems to be changing. There's nothing anymore that's not changing, nothing that's not arising and passing. Nothing is not in constant changing, impermanent. Nothing's not. And it's even more disorienting and like, what's going on here? And how does this relate to me? And you know, how does it relate to me? And getting a job to pay for dinner. So finally, the person goes to the Zen master and says, you know, I don't know what to do. There's 84,000 things are all changing. Everything's changing all at once. What do I do? And the Zen master says, oh, in that case, let go of the one who experiences the change. The person realizes that then, oh, everything was changing, but it never occurred to me to look here at me, myself and mine. That's the experiencer, the victim, the witness of all the change. But to let go of that? No, no, no. I mean, that's real, isn't it? And so then the person looks more closely at the witness, goes closely at the one who experiences. And lo and behold, it's just as empty as everything else. It also comes and goes. It's all part of that wonderful dance of coming and going. And the value of this is not so much to discover who you are, but to be able to do this, to be able to come into the sacred temple where we finally allow the miracle of life to be very simple, very quiet, just dropping all the ideas and just trusting to rest in the senses, sense doors, and just experience that contact with life that exists, the direct immediacy of life that is only here because we're alive. Proof that we're alive, to feel it, to sense it, to rest in it, and to start appreciating how much everything changes and constant, and realize that our attachments, things we cling to and hold on to, were based on the premise that they could be clung to. Turns out everything is so empty that clinging was an illusion. We thought we were clinging. And in a sense we were, but it was not to the things, it was just to our ideas of things. We cling to our friend. It turns out it's really our idea of our friend. We cling to our money, and it's the idea of the money. Cling to our good looks. It's the idea of our good looks. When everything is changing, there's nothing to cling to. And it teaches us to let go, to trust letting go. Maybe when the Buddha held up the flower, Makashapa let go. So seeing things as they are is to partly to see this inconstant flow and movement of experience. Seeing things as they are is to realize that in that flow and movement and inconstancy of things, that the ideas of self that we live under don't make sense anymore in that space. And there's the insight that none of this qualifies itself. All of this is empty, empty of self, empty of substantiality, just empty. And then maybe more important is the insight that any movement to hold on to it, to want something about it, to expect anything about this world like this, is suffering, is an ouch. And it isn't that life is suffering, but rather we learn that clinging to life is suffering. And things as they are, the third insight, the insight into not self, insight into suffering, is the insight, the understanding that nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to, because to do so is to suffer. And everything is suffering. Everything is actually suffering if we cling to it all. But nothing is suffering if we don't cling. So this step of the liberative dependent arising, seeing things as they are, can first appear as a glimmer, and then it's something that we get stabilized in. We start seeing and entering into more and more deeply if we trust it, if we allow ourselves to become intimate with this sense world, intimate with our sense faculties as they experience this living, buzzing, flowing world of sensations and the raw building blocks of what our life is built on. And it's not meant to dismiss the value of the more complicated ideas that we build on that. And it's not meant to be like the final answer to everything about life. That It's medicine to help us understand that it's safe and appropriate to let go. So now, after these days of being here on this retreat, you've done the equivalent. Traveled all the way to Japan, to Kyoto, got up early in the morning, peaceful and quiet. Became quiet yourself as you walked through the streets alone, into the temple grounds. The ancient trees are as silent as the stillness of the still night. And you enter into this ancient temple where people have meditated for maybe 600-700 years. And you're brought into this very special place where the vibe of hundreds of years of meditation feels crisp, peaceful, still, tremendous, kind of a stillness that feels alive. And to understand something about anything that's deep, to understand its emptiness first. To allow yourself the wonderful benefits, the wonderful blessing of becoming simple. Putting aside for now, the best you can, the complexities of life, the pasts and the futures, and the search for meanings, the stories we're trying to retell, understand, the problems we're trying to solve. Because this is a special time to be alive. This is a unique environment to be in. To be in a time where, after these days of practice, after, you know, being in this company of all these people who are doing the same, maybe you'll answer the koan. Why did Ma Kashyapa smile when the Buddha held up the flower? What is it about the uniqueness of holding up a sound, a taste, a smell, a sight, a feeling in the body, thought, just itself? How could someone smile? How can someone realize the Dharma in this such simplicity? It's by seeing things as they are at that level. Thank you very, very much. Keep practicing in the best way that you can, that's appropriate for you. And if you're at all inclined, or if it seems like the right thing, this might be the time in the retreat to practice more, to sit more, walk more, simplify even more. Maybe it's appropriate, be fine for some of you to stay up later, meditating into the evening, or waking up earlier to start earlier. The meditation hall is always open through the night. Except for that little time at California, 5:30 in the afternoon, when they turn Zoom off. So please, as you're inspired, this is your chance to sit with the koan of life. What is this life? What is this life when you don't use thoughts to answer the question? And finally, please, please, if you can, trust that you're more into the retreat than you realize. There's more momentum, there's much more here for you. So if you think that I'm not talking to you because you've been running around doing errands today, I'm talking to all of us. You're more in it than you realize. So you can give yourself over now. This is the time to do it on the retreat. Thank you all very much.